It's the All Things Strange Podcast. We are your hosts, Agent Anderson and
Agent Ether.
Come along as we examine UFO sightings, conspiracies, and all things strange. Check out the description where you can find all of our wonderful links on the Linktree, such as our Patreon, our Discord, where you can interact with the hosts, and more. This week's episode, The Delphos Ring. All right, everything's plugged in this time, I promise. We're going, let me see, say something.
Test.
Yes, okay, we're all plugged in. This is take two because the first time around I forgot to plug in Ether's microphone, so I'm editing that part out. All right, this topic was chosen by our Patreon subscribers, where we've got three tiers for you. The first tier will get you access to early access, after hours, and now new live video shows. Hey, they always said I got a face made for radio, and I'm putting it on the internet for all of you to enjoy or throw digital tomatoes at
That's terrible.
As you so desire. All right, the middle tier will get you bonus episodes. And finally, the top tier allows you to vote on upcoming topics such as this one. Well, feels like a deja vu here going on, right? Well, anyways, would you like to get us started with the Delphos Ring, Agent Ether?
Sure. We're talking about November 2nd, 1971. So this was a while ago, kind of a historical case. It was in the evening, about 7 p.m., and 16-year-old Ronnie Johnson was out tending his sheep on a small family farm. He heard a noise in the distance. He thought it was like an unbalanced washing machine or maybe a semi-truck driving over some rumble tracks. And in the distance, he sees this bright object. It's about 75 feet away, moving towards him. And it's so bright that at first he has trouble making out its shape. And when he could see it, he could make out that it was a short stem mushroom lit up with not just one light, but many colored lights, although he couldn't make out any texture because of the brightness. It was about 9 feet wide and 10 feet high, hovering a few feet above the ground. Now I
saw a couple of different descriptions of that. One description I saw said that it was hovering 1 foot above the ground, 2 feet, or like you said, several feet. But one description I saw from APRO, who investigated this case pretty much right after it happened, they said their bulletins anyway said that it was hovering 1 foot off the ground, and he couldn't really see if it was on the ground or if it was hovering on the ground.
Interesting.
Because it was so close to the ground.
And so bright.
Yes, and very, very bright.
So yeah. It was hard for him to make out. And the object apparently grew even brighter, and it began to rise up. There was a nearby shed, and it missed it by a few feet as it started to fade away. And Ronnie lost his vision for several minutes before seeing the object distant in the sky, at which time he went to get his parents, who would also come out and observe the object going away. It was bright and about half the size of the moon, and then it just went out of view.
Yeah, and that's, as far as the angular size of something in the sky, half the size of the moon is pretty large for an object in the sky. I mean, it might just be because of how bright it was. Now, I don't know if, I don't think you said, but I had here that he was somewhere between 70 and 90 feet away from the object. I'm not sure if you mentioned that one. So that means he was fairly close to it. I mean, if you just imagine 70 to 90 feet, 100 feet, that's like about a third of a football field. That's not that far. Like, that's pretty close.
It was definitely a close encounter.
Yeah. CE2, I think. Close encounter of the second kind.
So that's the basic sighting of the UFO.
Right. It was so bright, he compared it to an arc welder. And there is one interesting aspect to the case. When he was out there, his mom called him in for dinner and he didn't come in. So she and his father sat down, they ate dinner. And when they were done, they were like, this is kind of weird. He's not here yet. So they called out to him again. And eventually he came into the house. From Ronnie's perspective, the whole event, from he saw the UFO, he watched it for about 5 minutes, and then the light got brighter, and it flew over a shed that was in the backyard. And as it flew over the shed, it made a high-pitched, like a jet sound.
That's right. I forgot about that. It made a sound.
Yeah. And that's it. So that was about 5 minutes. Now, from the parents' perspective, the whole thing took about 30 minutes before he saw it. He came inside. He got them to come back out. So you have a time discrepancy there. You have some missing time. At least Ronnie has missing time. The parents did not seem to have any missing time. So that's kind of a strange aspect of the case. And if he was only less than 100 feet away from the object, I don't know. This might be an abduction story as well, but I couldn't find any hypnotism or lost memories or anything like that. We just have mysterious lost time. Did you see that, Agent Ether?
I did. See that. I had it in my notes. Ronnie himself would say that he never felt any like mysterious presence. He didn't see any figures or extraterrestrial beings. It's just from his point of view, it was an event that took place over a short amount of time.
Yeah, it's a very strange case. Now, after the light faded away, Ronnie took his parents to where he saw the object, and where the object was hovering or landed, we're not quite sure. They saw a glowing ring on the ground and the trees next to the area. It had landed next to some trees. I guess in this area, there are kind of trees all over the place. And there's pictures of this, by the way. So it landed, and they went to the area, and they saw a glowing ring on the ground. Not only that, the trees in the area were also glowing, and one of the trees had a branch that was over the area that was damaged, as if it had been, you know, knocked over or pulled down or something like that. Mrs. Johnson took a photo of this area pretty much right after the sighting had happened, and there are several other photos you can find of the Delphos ring online. Not that exciting. It's just a ring on the ground where nothing will grow, and it stayed that way for several years, actually. There's pictures from years after the event happened, and the ring is still there. Still, nothing is growing on the ring. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson touched the glowing soil, and it made their fingers numb. Mrs. Johnson wiped her fingers on her pants, kind of to wipe the dirt off or whatever, and it also made her leg numb where she wiped it off. I don't know if you saw anything about that, Agent Ether.
Well, I read that her hands, her fingers, would actually remain numb for several days.
Right. And that Ronnie's eyes were bloodshot and irritated for several days as well after the sighting.
So physical effects.
Right. This is a physical trace evidence. There are not that many of these. There's some, but they're fairly rare. Most sightings do not leave a physical trace evidence. And that's why this one is kind of exciting, even though it does lack the hallmark of a good sighting, which is multiple independent witnesses. Because after all, we just have these people's words for it. We don't know. They might be hoaxing it. That's one of the leading theories, is that it was some kind of hoax. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. The flock of sheep that Ronnie was tending to also acted strange in the following weeks. They acted erratic, confused, and scared, and they would occasionally jump over the fence for their pen and run for cover, as if they were trying to escape something. I don't know if those poor sheep. I don't know if
they're all traumatized. Yeah,
those poor guys. Ronnie had his dog with him. I saw on one article, I saw that it was named Snowball, but I was not able to substantiate that, so I don't know if that's true.
No, I saw an interview with Ronnie, and he said his dog's name was Snowball.
Okay, great. Yeah, it's a nice-looking dog. And the dog during the incident did not seem to freak out or anything. It was just quiet. But after that, the following evenings, the dog did not want to stay outside or even go outside and would scratch at the door to be let back in. So clearly the dog was a little freaked out about something as well. Did you, what did you see in the interview, Agent Ether?
I'm not telling you till the end because it's full of extra juicy details.
Ooh, extra juicy stuff. That's okay.
Are you moving on to the next day yet?
No, not the next. Well, maybe. I was going to talk about, I guess they did. There was several people they reported this to and people came to investigate. I wasn't going to go over that in detail, but I was going to say that the investigators looked at the branches. There actually were several branches that appeared to have been snapped off from above, and they did not see any vehicle tracks in the area. They didn't see any, any like footprints or machinery or anything that would account for that, because some of these branches were fairly large and it would be difficult to snap them without like a machine or like a chain or something like that to pull on them. Some of them were smaller. One investigator, right away, Ted Phillips came from APRO to investigate the incident. Well, not right away, but just a couple of days later. And I think that's who I read was there soon enough to still witness the glow of the ring, which apparently lasted for 4 days total. So it wasn't just the family. We have other witnesses who saw the area that was glowing. So that is a really interesting detail that they were not, at least that part was true, even if the rest was a hoax, right?
There were a couple witnesses who saw that the ring was glowing.
Yeah.
Because they had a reporter come out the very next day. So this would have been on the 3rd. And I thought it was kind of funny because the reporter brought her husband with her and her son-in-law because they were just curious about what was going on. And her name was Thaddeus Smith. And she said, upon arriving at the scene, I instantly knew that something had left evidence that it had been there because the surrounding areas were wet from the recent rains, but the ring itself was dry, but it was muddy in the middle. And she said, in the area around and inside the circle, there was nothing but darkness, giving a person an eerie feeling. The Johnson family, having lived in the Delphos community their entire life, are respectful, truthful, conscientious, trustworthy, and a well-thought-of, typical, hardworking Kansas farm family. In other words, vouching for their character.
Right. There's actually several people who did that. I saw, I think, two different quotes of people who vouched for their character, and they were not the sort of people to pull a prank like this, which is doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it is a very interesting piece of evidence because there are certain characters, like for example in the Kelly Goblins case, one of those witnesses was a known tall tale teller, and when they interviewed people, his drawings or the description he gave to the sketch artist was elaborated more than what other people said, things like that. But the other people all matched up. So you never know. There's always the chance that somebody could be a tall tale teller. Say that three times fast. But these people don't appear to be. Agent Ether?
Well, were you going to talk about Sheriff Enloe?
I was not. Would you like to?
Sure. Because they reported it first to him, to Sheriff Ralph Enloe, because he took an official report of the incident, and he actually had people come out and conduct different tests. They checked radiation levels, for example, and they found they were negative. And they took the first of a series of soil samples. And he said that the soil was white in color and very dry. And so he said, here's this white ring. It looks like a big donut sitting in the middle of a mud field. And they took statements. They had it photographed. And he said, we took actual soil samples. And I am 100% convinced that an incident happened and that the family told us it was credible.
Yeah, that's a good description there. Good quote. Even after it snowed, by the way, the dirt of the ring was dry. It would rain and the surrounding dirt would get wet or it would snow. And even one investigator poured water on it and the water just ran off as if it was waterproof.
So I read that the snow would be on the ring, but when you brushed it off the ring, it was dry underneath.
Yeah.
So it was snowing. There'd be like a blanket of snow and the snow would melt and it'd be muddy inside the ring and outside the ring. but the snow would last on the ring itself, and then you could like brush it off and still see the ring.
Yeah, it's weird, almost like it was waxed or something. I don't know. I'm not sure what would cause that, but it's a little on the strange side.
Yeah, and not only that, but it was dry down to several inches, like a foot.
Yeah, I think it was about a foot that they said when they took the soil samples. Now, when they took the soil samples, well, on the surface, another guy who investigated this was Clancy Tull, and he also investigated it for APRO. He said that the soil looked kind of like sand or like crystallized, and that there was a gray-white color to the soil that kind of looked like oxidization. That's sort of an interesting description. And when they took the soil samples, they noticed an unusual amount of like white stuff in the soil, more so than what you would expect.
Or the surrounding soil.
Right. It was different. The ring was completely different from the surrounding soil, because they did take control samples as well to compare to the sample that they took. It was noted by APRO that this white substance in the soil did appear in other trace evidence cases. They did not list those cases, but they said there were four other cases where they found something similar. I found a quote from Dr. John C. Mundy, who said that the phosphorescence implies a chemical change in the soil. Solar illumination would provide the light energy to populate the long-lived phosphorescent molecular energy states. Whatever that means, I don't know. But I also read that I think it was a different person than John Mundy, speculated that the white stuff could have been like sort of a type of fungus, and that the energy from the craft could have caused it to grow faster than normal in the area, which is why you would get the ring right there around where the ship was.
Maybe accelerate a natural phenomena.
Right, yeah, because it would feed off of that energy.
Well, I was reading that some of the composition of the soil would be similar to ground that had been recently cultivated, not the entire soil sample, but certain trace elements in the soil sample and the way it behaved when it was broken down would be the same way as if there was like grass ready to sprout or the soil had been turned and cultivated for planting recently. And so I found that interesting as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you look a little bit at the soil analysis?
I did. There was actually several times that people came on site to take a soil sample. So the sheriff did. And then there was a second researcher who came out, Ted Phillips, who was the founder and director for the Center for Physical Trace Research of UFOs. He was actually an engineer and a professional photographer that worked with Hynek at one point. And he was on site about a month after the incident. And he described the family as being very calm but curious about the whole event. So he took one of the soil samples. And then later, Jacques Vallée would also take a soil sample and have it analyzed by a lab over in France. And he says he got involved not just in this incident, but in UFOs in general, because he didn't have a choice. He can't think of anything more important than this work. And this was one of the events that he found was very important to his work. And he said specifically, he has this belief that some witnesses may be lying or telling, you know, fabricating details, but he says he doubts all the witnesses would be lying. And you have this case where you have several people coming out and seeing this ring for themselves, you know, in person, doing very strange things.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently there was a soil sample, an early soil sample that was preserved in someone's attic, like in a vial. And in 1999, Philip Budringer, who was a chemist and retired research scientist, had it analyzed again. And by 99, they had more sophisticated tools and were able to analyze it in more sophisticated ways. So he found that the soil itself had a high concentration of oxalic acid. And I guess that causes skin and eye irritation specifically. And he described the soil as feeling strange, like a slick crust, as if it were crystallized. It also showed high levels of fulvic acid, which occurs when there's high levels of biological activity. And the material in this case will coat the surface, making it partially hydrophobic or impervious to water. It also contained more calcium, salts, and was more acidic than the surrounding soil. So they had soil from outside the ring and soil from inside the ring, and they were two different, they had two different characteristics, two different compositions. And the soil within the ring also contained unidentifiable hydrocarbons.
Very interesting. So I found here what the quote I was talking about. It was actually from Dr. J. Robert Mooney, who is different than John C. Mundy. Similar names.
Wow.
Similar names, but different guys. So Dr. J. Robert Mooney suggested that such high concentrations of some of these things, like oxalic acid, could result from a low-temperature ionization engine. In other words, it could result from the UFO's propulsion system. That's an interesting suggestion, and that sure would match up with what the witness was saying he saw.
I read, though, that that's more of a byproduct of a combustible engine, and I feel like if there were extraterrestrials specifically, I would hope they'd have a little more sophisticated technology. So I wasn't sure about that conclusion.
That's true. And there are plenty of cases, even a lot that we've talked about, where somebody sees something that kind of looks like it has a fire coming out of it or something. And I don't know. I always thought that, that those kinds of cases, you would not be able to traverse the stars using, I don't know, you know what I mean? Using rocket technology or jet propulsion or anything like that. It would just take too long. So I'm with you right there. I agree that they would have an advanced propulsion system that would not be using, you know, the fuel that we're familiar with. But he's talking about an ionization engine, which basically is something, a technology that I don't think they had at the time, at least not working in a craft such as this. But if it was some sort of rocket or some sort of combustion or jet engine, something like that, then instead of being an extraterrestrial vehicle, it very well could have been some sort of test vehicle, a top secret test vehicle, perhaps that NASA had, that had gone off course and somehow ended up here and was chilling for a little bit, and then it took off again. I mean, I don't think that's outside of the question, and that could account for some of what the witness saw, what Ronnie saw.
But not for the missing time.
No, maybe not for the missing time. Although some skeptics have suggested that the missing time could simply be explained by just different accounts. You know, the Ronnie saw one thing, his parents saw another, and they are, you know, they don't remember exactly how much time. They weren't looking at watches. They just said it kind of felt like 5 minutes. It kind of felt like half an hour.
It's just such a big difference in time.
No, it is. Half an hour and 5 minutes. I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate, but half an hour and 5 minutes and half an hour, I don't think anybody's really going to mistake one for the other.
No, because it seems to me like for Ronnie, it just happened so fast. In a space of a few minutes, he'd had this experience. Whereas for his parents, they sat down and made their way through an entire dinner.
Right.
It's just such a big difference.
That is pretty interesting. Yeah. And I think his mom said it was at least 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Implying that it could have been a lot longer. And if you think about it, if you're sitting down and having a dinner, that could very, very easily take 30, 40 minutes, an hour, even depending on what you're eating, if you're talking a lot, you know, if you're getting up, sitting right. down, whatever.
And this was before cell phones, so they might have actually been talking to one another.
Yeah. It's possible. You never know. Although it is hard to talk with food in your mouth. Let's see. So yeah, the ring remained for a long time.
Years.
I don't know if it's still there, but it lasted for years and years. And that's
like the grass wouldn't grow there. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And there are pictures. That's kind of the fun thing about this case is there are pictures of the ring online. I was looking for pictures of the glowing of the ring. I didn't really find anything. Some people said that because it was glowing, it kind of messed with the way the film developed. Like I guess they were using Polaroids and the film just didn't come out, and they think that maybe whatever was there was interfering with the film.
You can still see pictures of the ring itself, though.
Yeah, there are plenty of pictures of the ring, which is interesting because it does match up with what the witness saw, or what he reported. All right, now there's a couple of possible explanations. We've hinted or spoken of a couple of them. The perennial favorite, Philip J. Class, known to some people as Philip J. Ass, some people call him that. He's no longer with us, but he wasn't always a very nice person when it came to these things, and sometimes actually attacked people. But I mean, not physically, but you know, with the pen, which is apparently mightier than the sword, unless you're actually being stabbed by one. But his explanation, did you see his explanation, Agent Ether?
Yes.
would you like to?
So there's sheep because he's a sheep farmer. This is the one, right, that you're talking about? Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's sheep because it's a sheep farm and they're all going to need a trough.
Yep.
And they're all going to kind of be centered around this trough. They're going to be eating. They're going to be peeing. And if you take the trough away, what's left is a circular region on the ground where grass probably doesn't want to grow.
Because of pee.
Because of pee.
So he says the sighting is a hoax and the ring is from pee.
Pee.
From, yeah.
And an excitable 16-year-old boy.
Yeah, because as we all know, every 16-year-old is an idiot. You know, they're not capable of seeing things and saying stuff in a coherent way.
Yeah.
But no, that one was hilarious because, well, I just think about it, right? The people did say that the Johnsons, they did say that there was a trough somewhere in that area at some point in time. But I'm picturing the sheep around a trough. I've seen animals before at the zoo. Hell, I've even been to a farm once or twice. And
city boy.
They don't, in my experience, animals don't just stand there at a water trough all day drinking and peeing at the same time. They tend to drink, and then when they're done drinking, they go somewhere else. And they don't tend to drink and pee at the same time. I don't know. That explanation kind of makes sense on the surface, but it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But I suppose, you know, if we're talking about a strange mushroom-shaped object, anything's possible, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about the sheep pee explanation, Agent?
Well, it is an explanation.
It certainly is, yeah. That's the most plausible one that I saw as far as the skeptical side.
Yeah, yeah. What other ones did you see? I didn't see any other ones.
Well, just the ET hypothesis, basically.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's not a skeptical hypothesis.
No. But that is
of course, there is just the fairy ring theory. That it's just a fairy ring.
Yes, that is another possibility. Yeah. Would you like to tell us about that?
No, that's all I know. I actually don't know a lot about fairy rings. Well, I figured you'd done part of your episode, right? You've had bonus episodes where you've talked about fairy rings.
Well, yeah. So I in some of the bonus episodes, I'm reading from a book called The Fairy Faith of Celtic Folk.
Right.
From way back in the early 1909 or something. It's from a long time ago. And it talks about basically the the fairy, the beliefs of people, like of Celtic people, like it's all in the title. Why do I even say that? But it hasn't mentioned fairy rings necessarily like this one, but there are basically, there are two different kinds of fairy rings. There's the fairy rings that are caused by funguses or mushrooms that just so happen to grow in a ring. And sometimes those are attributed to fairies. And I don't remember any anecdotes talking specifically about fairy rings yet, but I am not even halfway through the book yet, so I'm sure it'll get there sooner or later. But maybe there was one and I'm just not remembering it. I don't know. But there's also fairy rings where they're not sure if it's caused by, you know, something supernatural or what. And there's certainly plenty of them that don't seem to have been caused by funguses or mushrooms or anything like that. There are, I did find plenty of UFO cases that had a ring similar to this one. So there are plenty of cases like that. And some of those are referred to as fairy rings as well. So you have the fairy rings that actually have to do with fairies or spirits, supernatural beings, and also some that are associated with, you know, the paranormal in general or UFOs. And then you have the ones associated with fungus.
Thank you for that thorough explanation.
Apologies for, I'm having trouble forming thoughts here, so I'm doing my best. I've got, the brain fog is real, people, or maybe I'm just old. I don't know.
So I have some additional items to add.
Sure.
You mentioned there were no additional witnesses, but the sheriff, Sheriff Enlau, actually reported there were similar sightings.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right?
I did see that.
There was a similar incident in Minneapolis on that same night by a reserve police officer, Lester Ehrensberger. And unfortunately, I could not find any additional information about this person.
Yeah, the only thing I found on that one was that he saw a similar object. His description was similar, and he saw it from a farther distance. He didn't see it close up.
A really bright object in the distance.
Yeah, and from what I saw for that, he couldn't make out a shape because it was so bright. He just saw a bright object in the distance. But it was on the same day and
around the same time, too, is my understanding.
Yeah, so who knows? It was not in the same place. So we can't say necessarily it was the same object, but it was similar and it was, you know, that's pretty interesting. Oh yeah, there is one explanation that, another skeptical explanation that could explain this until you kind of think about it for a minute. So in 1972, the National Enquirer announced a $50,000 cash award for anybody who could provide evidence that UFOs came from outer space.
I find that so amusing. I've seen that referenced in several places, and I'm like, well, of course they did. They could have offered millions of dollars,
right?
Because more, I think it's to stir up interesting news stories than actual expectations that someone is going to be able to come forward with concrete proof. So,
well, there were lots of people that did come forward. I think they had about 1,000 entries, give or take.
Yes, which is to be expected.
Of course.
However, none of those entries provided actual concrete proof.
No, they did not award the $50,000 cash prize, but they did give this family $5,000 for their evidence they provided in the Delphos ring case. And this case was reviewed by a panel of scientists. Some of them were from APRO. So they thought there was something there worth awarding money for. And $5,000 in 1972 or 73, whichever, is about $35,000 in today's money. So that's not nothing. That's a decent chunk of change. And then, of course, $50,000 would probably be, you know, 10 times that. So $350,000, that's a lot of money. The panel was Dr. James A. Harder, Dr. J. Allen Hynek,
of course,
Dr. Robert Cregan, and Dr. Frank B. Salisbury, and my favorite, Dr. Leo Sprinkle. It's not my favorite. He's just got such a silly name. I love it. So yeah, they looked at the evidence and they concluded that, well, we can't say for certain this was alien, but we can say that it is definitely unexplainable based on the information they had at that time. By the way, we talked about another case really recently, the Betz Sphere, that also was looked at by the National Enquirer, and there were some shenanigans involved. So I don't want to give any punchlines.
Good case, though. Go back and listen. That was a good case.
Yeah, that was, what, 2 weeks ago, I think? Yeah, so excellent case. I don't want to give any spoilers, but there were some shenanigans involved with the National Enquirer panel, which I'm not sure if the panel was the same panel as this one. I'd have to double-check my notes.
It had some of the same names.
Yeah, Alan Hynek was definitely on the panel.
Yeah.
Maybe some of the other names are the same too. I have to double check the year. So I don't remember if it was the exact same panel or if it was a different panel. Not sure. But anyways, some skeptics say that the Delphos ring was a hoax perpetrated to win the prize money. But the problem with that is that sounds great on the surface, right? You say, okay, they just made up the story so that they could win the prize money. That is very, very plausible in my opinion. Now, the problem with that theory is that they reported this to the police and to journalists and to other people in 1971 before the National Enquirer announced their $50,000 cash award. So that one doesn't really pan out so much. If it was hoaxed, I mean, that's definitely a possibility. I'm not ruling that out. If it was hoaxed, it was hoaxed for a different reason entirely. It had nothing to do with the National Enquirer panel. That was just gravy. But if they hoaxed it, they didn't really make any money from it. Of course, some people hoax things without making money on it. I talked about a liar's club, and that was, you know, the first cattle mutilation case in history was actually made up by a liar's club, which is kind of interesting. That was a long time. That was episode 20, I think. That might have been on a few classics. I'm not sure. But there have been people to hoax things. But usually when somebody hoaxes something, they want to get something out of it. And they don't appear to have gotten anything at all out of this. So who knows? I don't know. That doesn't mean it wasn't hoaxed. That just means that I'm not convinced it was hoaxed. I just think that was one possibility. What do you think?
I don't know. Ronnie definitely seemed... So I saw an interview with him, and it was just a few years ago. And hearing him talk, for me, he sounded very believable. Like, in that he believed what he was saying was the truth. And after so long to hold true to a story like that, after all of this time, I think it says something. Not like, well, I was young. And I thought it would be funny, you know, to hold true to your story. And in the interview I saw, he was showing the investigator a collection of his paraphernalia from the time. So photos of the ring itself, photos of his family, newspaper clippings. It was obviously something that was very important to him and had been pivotal in his life.
Yeah. And people often get negative attention for this sort of thing. So many years later, you think if anything, he would say it was a hoax, whether or not it was, just to get people to leave him alone, you know?
Exactly.
This is actually a fairly prominent case at the time, although it's, you know, over the years, it's kind of fallen by the wayside. It's not quite as prominent as it used to be, but it's still considered one of the more important trace evidence cases in the history of ufology. So you'd think that, you know, maybe he wouldn't want the attention. But that's interesting that even pretty much to this day, or fairly recently, he maintains that what he saw is what he saw.
And he adds a couple other details that I didn't find elsewhere. He says his mom actually went back to the house after she sighted the object to get her camera. But it didn't have a flash bulb, so she tried to take several pictures, and they came out like steam coming off of water. And I wasn't sure what he meant by that. That's just what he said. And he said the trees that were close together near the circle were burned white, like the dirt, the trees in the area.
Interesting.
And so I talked about the reporter coming out the next day and the way He recalls it, reporters weren't interested in the story at first, and it wasn't until several months later and word got around that scientists and investigators started to come out. And he recalls someone coming out with a Geiger counter and the soil being radioactive, going to red right away on the Geiger counter.
Interesting, because I read that the soil was tested and it was not radioactive.
Right, not radioactive. So this is just his recollection. And he said some scientists came out and his dad said, hey, if you're going to touch that soil, you might want to wear some gloves. And of course, they didn't listen. And their hands went numb. Their fingers went numb, at which point they went back to their car and took out some gloves to get the soil samples.
Whoops.
And he said when they took soil samples, the white part of the dirt would float on top of the water and it wouldn't take in any moisture. The crop circle, or not the crop circle, but the circle, the ring, stayed there for 7 years.
Wow.
Before it faded away.
7 years.
Seven years. And he said in the fall, the leaves from the trees wouldn't stay on that area. So you'd have like the circle with the leaves in the middle and the leaves on the outside, but they wouldn't stay on the inside. And of course, we talked about when everything snowed, how the snow would remain on the circle. It would melt last, he said. And he related an experience where he brought in some sheep from a neighbor. Years later, there'd been a good rain, and he went over to check the fence after the rain, and he was going across the creek, or as he said, crick, which I've heard before.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that,
too. I've heard that before. He's gone across this creek, and he comes across a big circle-size football field ring.
Interesting.
Huge. But he said he kept it quiet and to himself. He didn't want to tell anybody about it. And he said that was because when he was in school, he actually had to drop out. He quit school because everybody would tease him. They'd say, here comes the UFO man. And if he had to do it all over again, it changed his life so negatively, he wouldn't have told anybody about the incident at all, which is why he didn't tell anybody about other similar incidences, other experiences that he had.
Yeah, I mean, more often than not, it seems like it's not a good idea to report these things publicly. I was looking at earlier when I was doing some busy stuff, I was looking at a thread on Reddit where somebody on Ask Reddit, which is like the biggest subreddit, they asked, have you ever seen anything that, I forget the exact question, maybe I'll bring it up in the after hours, but there are people on there, there's thousands of replies, and many of them were UFO sightings. Maybe they're all making it up, I don't know. But it's interesting, because I've said before on the show, I suspect that a lot of UFO sightings, maybe even most of them, go unreported, because people just don't want the attention.
Well, he and his brother also had an experience. So they were back at the house, and he said 3 years after the initial incident, they were out at the house. They heard a sound coming over the house. They went out to investigate. They didn't see anything, but their cars wouldn't start, and it burnt all the wiring in the house.
Really?
Burnt it all out, yeah.
Wow.
So, but again, he didn't report it to anyone, but that's what he said. He said the cars wouldn't start, the wiring was shot, and they heard the craft. He said it was the same noise, but he thought it might have been camouflaged.
Interesting. Yeah, there are a lot of sightings where you wonder, okay, is this how something would behave if it was malfunctioning? And who knows, maybe his initial sighting, it was having some sort of technical issue, and that's why he was able to see it in the first place.
Yeah, maybe. The most interesting thing for me about this case is how bright the object was.
Right.
How he describes it as being as bright as an arc welder.
Yeah.
Like that would have lit up the whole area, like daytime, like the sun.
Right, yeah.
And no wonder the animals were freaked out. Although I found it interesting that at the time of the incident, they were still and calm. It wasn't until after the craft had left that the sheep started to bleat, and the dog started, you know, going a little wild. So that it's just a lot of interesting little details about this case.
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting one. I had fun reading about it. As far as like what it was, I'm kind of on the fence. I don't know. We don't have multiple independent witnesses. We do have that one witness who saw something in the distance, but you could dismiss it. On the other hand, it does bear a lot of similarities to other UFO sightings. There's an awful lot of UFO sightings where the craft is lit up and it gets brighter when it moves. That's very common. And it kind of makes you wonder, okay, let's just say, what if that is a UFO or, you know, an extraterrestrial vehicle? Could that be somehow tied to their propulsion system? Could that be a side effect of the propulsion system? I don't know. You'd think that they'd have to have something pretty wild like the Alcubierre drive, which I've talked about on a previous episode, that allows you to bend space-time around the ship and would theoretically allow you to do things like move from a dead stop to going multiple times the speed of sound, like we've talked about in cases before. What do you think about this one, Agent Ether?
Well, also, I found it interesting the size of the object.
Right.
It wasn't the size of a football field, right? It was smaller.
Maybe it was like a probe or something.
Exactly. Yeah. That is exactly what I was thinking, is that rather than a spacecraft maybe with extraterrestrials, which, you know, it's hard for us to know, if anything, it sounds like a probe.
Right. Yeah. And there are many, again, many cases where smaller UFOs are seen and a larger one is seen in the area. So that's not unusual either. So I don't know. This one is it's a really good sighting and it bears similarities. So I'm not ready to dismiss it. I think it's interesting. But on the other hand, there's really only one witness. So it doesn't necessarily carry as much weight for me, although it does have the physical evidence. It's just a really fascinating case. Like I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of similar, a surprising number of cases actually where a ring or circle on the ground is left behind after a UFO sighting. So let's talk about a couple of them, because why not? First up, the mystery rings in Australia, or in the mystery rings in Straya, because, you know, we've got, you know, our number one fan, Aussie Mima's probably listening in the show right now. I still haven't figured out the chat yet. I'm not sure how this chat works, but it shows you that there's somebody else in the audience, but it does not show you who it is. So I'm not sure who's there. But there is somebody in there. Kind of creepy. But anyways, this one happened 145 miles northwest of Melbourne. And it was a farm of Jeff Bibby at Navarre. N-A-V-A-R-R-E. Navarre? I don't know. It happened September 1972. So around the same time as the Delphos Circle. About, you know, more or less a year later. The witness found two circles of bare ground, two circles that were 80 feet in diameter, and the stripes that made up the circles were about 2 feet wide. The soil seemed more or less normal on the surface, except nothing would grow on it. So it's very similar to the Delphos Circle, except the circle was there was two circles actually next to each other. They were much, much larger. When Jeff dug down, he found that the soil was heavily impregnated with a white substance unlike anything he had ever seen, just like the Delphos Circle. Pretty interesting. When he took the substance and rubbed it between his fingers, it disappeared, almost as if it just evaporated into nothing. Pretty interesting. He took several samples in, out, and on the rings, and only the soil on the rings was abnormal, although I was unable to find any soil analysis like they did in the Delphos ring case, so who knows. Now, the Navarre rings, I guess as they're known, might have been caused by a UFO. However, the Bibbies did not see a UFO. They just found the rings and had no idea how they got there. However, their neighbor, Mrs. Lorna Slorak, who lives on the neighboring farm, the farm adjacent to theirs, saw something strange in November of 1969, 3 years before the rings appeared. At midnight, she was traveling in a car with her mother-in-law and father-in-law when she saw a bright light moving across the sky. As it approached, she saw that it wasn't one light, but actually a circle of lights made up from alternating large and small lights. Kind of makes me think of, what was that case? Oh, my brain is just not working. The Lubbock lights, kind of maybe something like that maybe, right? She couldn't really see what the lights were attached to, if anything, and they did not make any sound at all as they traveled. She just saw lights. She told the mother and father-in-law to look. The mother-in-law looked and saw it, while the father-in-law looked in the wrong direction, maybe at a tree. didn't see anything. He was driving. He did not see the lights. So he turned on his high beams to get a better look. And when he turned on the high beams, the lights in the sky blinked out. They just turned off.
Interesting.
Kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this is a hot area, perhaps part of some sort of triangle. I'd have to look at the map, but maybe it's part of a triangle we've covered in the past. And that's that sighting. I have another one from December 14th, 1973, 36 miles north of El Paso de Robles, California, which I looked it up. It's in the Central Coast area. So we've probably driven through there more or less. Lance Mathias and Mike Andrews were driving in a van at about 9:40 p.m. when they saw an amber-colored spheroid less than a mile away, and they estimated that it was about 800 feet off the ground. At the bottom of the spheroid was a black cone-shaped appendage that projected a red beam that reminded one of the witnesses of tracer rounds from a Vulcan gun. I guess that you know, like the machine gun on a helicopter.
When, for a minute, I thought you meant Vulcan from Star Trek.
No, that's actually what they called the gun.
After the Vulcans from Star Trek.
Possibly, yeah. It's that's entirely possible. I didn't look up that detail. But you know, when you're shooting a machine gun, sometimes they'll use tracer rounds so you can see where the bullets are going. You know, one out of every 10 bullets or whatever it is will be a tracer bullet. And then you can see the exact track that the bullets are taking so that if they're affected by wind or something and they have a curvature, then you'll be able to see where they're going and you can hit your target more accurately. Anyways, he said that that's what the red beam reminded him of, only it didn't arc like a bullet might in its flight path. The beam, when it hit the ground, created a great disturbance where it struck, sending clouds of dirt and debris 20 feet into the air. And here's a quote from Mathias. The beam shot out, stopped, and then shot out again in intermittent spurts. When this was done, the cone was drawn into the sphere and a cloud of vapor became visible where the cone had been. I was ready to jump into the ditch along the side of the road. I thought somebody in a helicopter gunship had flipped. So that must be terrifying, you know? They didn't hear any sound at all from the craft. After this happened, the object shot away at a high rate of speed, diminishing to the size of a star and then disappearing. They went over to where the object had been hovering and destroying dirt, apparently, and they saw that the ground was glowing. Here's a quote. It was a red, then a yellowish glow, and the center was nothing. It looked like a ring. After 15 minutes, the glow subsided, leaving the two men in darkness. They turned on their flashlights and saw two humanoid figures.
Oh, no. Oh, hell no.
Yeah, no, thank you. They were metallic, and they looked like crinkly aluminum, were about 6 feet tall, cylindrical in shape, and had a twinkling luminescence where their eyes should be. And they also...
We've talked about a case where the skin of an alien was like crackly aluminum or something.
I was about to mention that in just a moment.
Oh, okay.
They also said that whatever the creatures were, they waved their arms around below their waists. I'm not sure.
Happily?
I guess. I don't know, maybe. They were, yeah.
I have this very strange mental image. I know. Now.
So bizarre. Did they whistle while they worked? I don't know. But yeah, it's actually, they were shown a drawing from the Pascagoula abduction.
Okay.
And they said that the creatures looked exactly like the drawing from that abduction, which we've done a case on. We've done an episode on the Pascagoula abduction. So go check that out if you're interested. Really interesting case. And yeah, so that's that sighting. And it doesn't say, at least the report I saw did not say what happened after that. Did the creatures abduct them? Did they run away saying, whoop, 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 you know, like, I don't know. It didn't really say what happened after that. That's just the report. So yeah, that's all there is to that one. Pretty interesting. There are actually a bunch of cases that had similarities to the Delphos Ring case, and maybe we'll get to some more of them in the future. But for now, that's pretty much all we've got for you this time. Any final thoughts, Agent Ether?
Did you know you too can win up to $1 million?
Oh, it's $1 million now, huh?
It's $1 million if you can provide extraterrestrial video footage to Ring, the doorbell company owned by Amazon.
Really?
Jeff Bezos got some mad money.
Yeah.
He's willing to cough up a million of it if you can provide proof of aliens.
He is so rich. I haven't tried it out myself, but I've heard there's like a calculator online or something called Spend Jeff Bezos's Money. And like, you put in objects that you want to buy, or, you know, mansions, yachts, whatever. And it's like impossible to spend his fortune. So if you're that wealthy, I could see, you know, whatever, $1 million, dude. If I was that wealthy, I would do the same thing.
Whenever we order anything off of Amazon, I go, well, making Bezos just a little richer today.
Just a little, but just it's so a little bit. Convenient.
It really is. And half the time we go to a store to buy what we want to purchase, and they either don't have it, or it's not the right one, or it is ridiculously overpriced.
You'll look on their website. It'll say, sure, we have it in stock. Come on down. You get there. Not in stock.
Not in stock. And the employees are not helpful.
Yeah. I don't blame them, because they're getting paid minimum wage. So why would they care about their job? But on the other hand, as a shopper, it can be frustrating. There have been several times when I've gone somewhere and said, hey, I'm looking for this. Do you have it? They say no. And then I go and find it myself. You know, there's plenty of cases of that, which I won't get into now. But
at the same time, retail's hard. We've all worked retail.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And it can be frustrating. It can be exhausting. And some customers can be overly demanding. So I get it.
Karens.
I definitely get it.
Yeah. Gotta love the Karens.
We didn't call it, when I was working retail, I didn't call them Karens. But, you know, actually, to be fair, I had just as many, if not more, problems with male customers than I did with female customers. It was a case-by-case basis. I didn't see any sort of profile that said, oh no, here comes a woman, you know. It was just sometimes you got a problematic customer.
What does Agent Redacted call the male versions of Karens?
I don't know. Kevins?
Kevin. I think it was Kevin. Kevins and Karens.
Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah.
Silly. He's a silly guy. He just got his learner's permit. So yeah. He's super amped. So you can post your well wishes to Agent Redacted on the Facebook page, and I can show them to him.
And if you come to Santa Rosa, maybe stay off the roads.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that's all we got for you this time. Until next time.
Keep it strange.
Oh, yeah. And also, I forgot the bit I usually add at the end. If you enjoyed the show, you could always help us out by suggesting the show to your friends, leaving us a good review wherever you listen or view. And I guess now that we are doing video, there's like buttons and stuff on YouTube. And I guess, I don't know, I've heard that clicking those buttons does good things. So.
God, we're so old.
Subscribe, and I guess there's a notification bell, so ring the bell and tickle that like button.
Oh my God.
Smash that like button, the thumbs up, yay. I don't know, whatever, guys. Help us out. It really does help grow the show, and growing the show does provide new opportunities for us that we can do really cool things. Like buy webcams that
was
provided by our Patreon subscribers. So thank you guys so much. Anyways.
All right, guys.
Until next time.
Until next time. Bye.